Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the so-called Jobs Act, now heading to the White House for the president's signature. Jeff Mahoney, the general counsel of the investor watchdog group, the Council of Institutional Investors, joins us to assess the damage that this deregulation of Wall Street in the name of job creation will do to unsophisticated mom-and-pop investors who will soon be prey to boiler room hucksters, now free to advertise in almost any medium. Then a former health insurance insider, Wendell Potter, joins us to analyze why the Affordable Care Act is vulnerable to having the individual mandate overturned by the Supreme Court. A former chief corporate spokesman for Cigna and the head of corporate communications at Humana, Wendell Potter is the author of Deadly Spin. An insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Then finally, we will assess the chances of Kofi Annan's so-called peace plan for Syria going anywhere, given that as a precondition, the opposition will be asked to surrender to the regime that is killing its own people and trust that they have any interest in reform. A former Syrian diplomat and professor of Middle East studies at the National Defense University, Muharraf Shujaati, joins us to analyze the Annan plan and discuss the Arab League summit now underway in Baghdad, where Syria is on the agenda but not present, having been expelled from the Arab League. And joining us now is Jeff Mahoney, the general counsel of the Council of Institutional Investors and a professor of law at the Washington College of Law at American University. Previously, he was counsel to the chair of the Financial Accounting Standards Board. He currently co-chairs the Financial Accounting Standards Board's Investors Technical Advisory Committee and serves on the NASDAQ Listing Qualifications Hearing Panel and the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board Standing Advisory Group. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you.
And you're the chief counsel with the investor watchdog group, the Council of Institutional Investors. Who are your clients?
The Council is a not-for-profit association that represents public, corporate, and union employee benefit plans from across the country.
Pension plans, largely, I take it.
Yes.
So, obviously, you're concerned about the passage of the so-called Jobs Act. And what is it about this act? I mean, there was the bill went from the House, I think, only 26 Democrats voted against it in the House. It went into the Senate. There was an effort in the Senate led by Senator Levin and others to put some teeth into this bill. The bill was originally pushed in the House by Eric Cantor. It's gone back to the House. Apparently some concessions were made, but give me a sense of whether there was any consumer protection put back into this bill.
On the Senate side, there was some consumer protection provisions put into the bill with respect to the crowdfunding provisions.
Explain crowdfunding for the audience because they don't know that one.
Well, crowdfunding is a way to access capital through the internet. So there's a question of how that can be done without investors being scammed. That part of the bill, though it was of great interest to many retail investors, was not the focus of the council's concerns. Our focus and our members' focus is on corporate governance best practices. Our members believe that if companies have good corporate governance best practices, that enhances long-term shareholder value, so that therefore benefits our fiduciaries of our members, which are mainly workers and retirees. So the area that we focused on in the bill is a section of the bill that is often referred to as the IPO on-ramp section. That section, in essence, allows IPOs
initial public offerings,
newly formed public companies, from avoiding certain provisions of the federal securities laws for some period of time. Some of those provisions are best practices as viewed by our membership, And therefore, we raise concerns about those best practices being deferred for these newly formed companies.
Well, some of these regulations, the Sarbanes-Oxley bill, which is now being effectively gutted, these regulations were put in place after the end of the dot-com bubble and the collapse of Enron. And under this new jobs bill, which is now heading for the president's desk and his signature, companies with up to $1 billion in annual revenues would be free to ignore for the first 5 years as a public company these regulations that were put in place. I mean,
that's right. We, as well as SEC Chairman Mary Schapiro, raised concerns about the triggering qualifications for these, quote, emerging growth companies to be able to avoid regulations. As you indicated, it's $1 billion and $700 million in market cap. That has been estimated to encompass most all initial public offerings in this country. Some have said more than 90% of IPOs would qualify for these exemptions.
So for somebody like you who is trying to advise your clients who are pension plans, et cetera, about a good, secure investment, under the new bill, then you won't know what they're paying the CEOs. I mean, that's always that's the kind of canary in the minefield, isn't it? How much the founding partners are pocketing.
There's some very important information and shareholder rights that it will not be allowed for some period of time for these new companies because of the legislation. One area that our members were very supportive of, and that is consistent with our membership-approved policies, is that Dodd-Frank required public companies to have an annual advisory vote on the executive compensation packages. This provision, which became effective last year for most public companies, significantly increased the level of communication between share owners in compensation committees at companies with respect to the compensation packages of their executives and how those packages enhance long-term performance. This bill would defer the application of that provision for IPOs for up to 5 years.
And this then would make the particularly unsophisticated investors and kind of mom-and-pop investors and your clients vulnerable to what's referred to as pump and dump, right? Because just to explain that for a second, this bill allows advertising of stocks in almost any medium, right?
That's another provision of the bill that does allow greater advertising of IPOs and newly public companies than would have been allowed under existing federal securities laws.
So they'll be advertised on television just like on Glenn Beck's TV show. They used to advertise gold bullion and gold coins and stuff like that. They'll have that ability to go on television and tell investors about this fabulous offering.
Well, you're correct to point out that many of the provisions of this legislation focus on or will have an impact on retail investors. And many believe, including SEC Chairman Mary Schapiro, that there are some dangers in this bill for retail investors, where, as you pointed out, they will get less information. In some cases, they may get more inaccurate and misleading information that would be permitted under the existing federal securities laws and regulations.
But the pump and dump, it refers to the notion, and this is why it looks like the Jobs Act has been a carte blanche for pump and dump fraudsters, because if you're allowed to use the media to pump up your product in misleading and exaggerated ways, then all that money flocks in, and because of the five-year window, the investor doesn't know what the CEOs and the founding partners of the IPO are doing with this money, and then at any point or other, I take it they're free to just dump the shares after they've taken what they want.
There is that danger. It's going to be curious to see how this plays out and whether or not this increases the level of investment scams that workers, retirees, senior citizens, and others may be exposed to. Time will tell, but there is certainly provisions in this bill that will make it easier for those who want to abuse the system have more leeway to do that under the federal securities laws. Now, one issue here is that this legislation will result in rulemaking by the SEC, so we'll have a number of rules put out for comment by the SEC to implement this law. So there will be an opportunity for our members and others to weigh in on those proposals. However, the proposals will be limited given the language in the bill. There won't be a lot of leeway for the SEC on some of these provisions given the language in the bill. But that's one way that our members and we will participate in by providing comments as this law is put into regulations.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Mahoney, the General Counsel of the Investor Watchdog Group, the Council of Institutional Investors. He's also a professor of law at the Washington College of Law at American University. So what are you telling your members then to avoid?
Well, we're actually having our semi-annual member conference next week here in Washington, and we have asked three of the leading security law professors in the country to take a look at that issue, and they're going to produce some issue briefs for our members focusing on the various provisions of the bill and discuss in those issue briefs what are the implications for institutional investors and what they ought to think about doing to prepare for the implementation of this bill.
But Jeff Mahoney, the SEC has not proven pretty, you know, they didn't notice Madoff, et cetera. They tend to be, you know, after the barn door is open and the horse is down the paddock. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it?
They've had some issues over the years, including recently, as you mentioned, with the Madoff situation. But sitting here in Washington, they are the only federal agency who has, as part of its mission, investor protection. So though they have some issues, they're the only body in town that has as part of its mission to consider and look at these investor issues. So we deal quite closely with them, and we will provide input to them as they go through the rulemaking and do what we can to improve upon this legislation through the regulatory process.
I don't know whether you had a chance to talk with Mary Shapiro, the head of the SEC, but I would think this new Jobs Act that the president's going to sign, it's going to give her a lot more work, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
And at the same time, the Republican Congress is cutting her budget, aren't they?
That is correct. She issued a letter on March 13th raising a number of concerns about the legislation, including the one you mentioned, the additional work, including the deadlines that the legislation sets for rulemaking. And as you point out, the SEC has not received the funding that they've requested. We've been active in that area as well. During Dodd-Frank, there was some provisions in the earlier versions of Dodd-Frank that would have provided them a stable source of independent funding. We were very supportive of those provisions, but during the conference committee, those provisions were taken out of the legislation, unfortunately. So the SEC is left in the position of Dodd-Frank added a number of new requirements to their existing requirements, and this will add more, and yet they don't have the funding to do the work, including the oversight that's needed.
But Jeff Mahoney, the people who argued against this bill, and as I say, initially in the House, there was very little objection. 24 Democrats voted against it in the House. In the Senate, a number of senators tried to have amendments, but Harry Reid pushed it through, requiring the 60-vote threshold. So everybody got to vote and express their objections, but it essentially didn't matter because there wasn't enough opposition to get to 60. There's some modifications made. The vote in the House, it was 380 to 41. So that's a pretty overwhelming vote. So it's a done deal, right?
It is a done deal. Fully expect the president will be signing this very shortly. Watching this in Washington, it's not unlike some things that have occurred in the past. You know, they renamed this legislation as it went along to the Jobs Act and to give the impression that this legislation will increase jobs, yet I'm not aware of a single piece of evidence that indicates that that's the case. It will be very interesting to see how this plays out. Will it create any jobs? And will it result in some problems in the market, particularly at the retail level? And will that have a negative impact on investor confidence? I think it's possible, and certainly Mayor Shapiro has shared this view, that if this does increase the amount of fraud in the marketplace, that could lead to a lower level of investor and consumer confidence in our market, and that would be bad for our members and for all investors.
Well, what I was suggesting earlier, though, is that if the people that are warning about how this will enable a lot of fraud and bring back the boiler rooms, and with the added advantage of now being able to advertise on just about any medium, they're going to be a lot of unsophisticated investors are surely going to be taken in, or at least they are vulnerable to this kind of onslaught that's going to come. I was suggesting that the underfunded SEC is going to have more work, not just in what you're talking about in preparing for the implementation of the new Jobs Act, but if the worst happens, as many predict, and there's a vast increase in fraud, they're not going to have the enforcement mechanisms to deal with it, right?
That's an excellent point, given their current funding status. If there is a significant uptick in fraud as a result of this legislation, you really have to question whether or not they're going to have the resources to deal with it. I think it's going to be a real challenge. They already are challenged right now in their oversight and enforcement activities, given their lack of resources and given all the new requirements put upon them in Dodd-Frank. I don't see that improving anytime soon, and if that is the result of this bill, that there is more fraud, it's going to be very difficult for the SEC to deal with it effectively, given the current level of their funding.
Well, just in closing, Jeff Mahoney, the president is going to sign it, and already in the Senate, Ron Wyden, a liberal Democrat, has said, as we move towards November, people are going to have to show some results. In other words, the Democrats are in a position where the Republicans can essentially blackmail them, and that's probably why they voted for this bill, right? If they voted against it, the Republicans would be screaming from the rafters that the Democrats are against jobs. Presumably, is that the motive why the president's? He's just been suckered into this by Eric Cantor to vote for something that sounds like it's about jobs, but is in fact about a huge payoff to bottom feeders on Wall Street.
Well, there's no question that renaming this the Jobs Act had some impact on who was supportive of this and how quickly the bill moved through Congress. And say, we'll see. We'll have to wait and see what the result is. Maybe it won't create the problems that Chairman Shapiro and others have indicated that it may. For our members, you know, we're going to have less information than we had before, less ability to oversee executive comp than we had before. This will be an additional risk that our members will have to take into account when managing their portfolios that they otherwise would not have had to spend time on but for this legislation. But I say the real impact is going to be at the retail level, and we'll just have to see how that plays out. This could end up being one of those bills that a few years down the line many point to as a big mistake that has could potentially increase the levels of fraud, particularly at the retail level.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Mahoney, the general counsel of the Investor Watchdog Group, the Council on Institutional Investors. He's also a professor of law at the Washington College of Law at American University, and previously he was counsel to the chair of the Financial Accounting Standards Board. He's currently co-chairs the FSAB's Investors Technical Advisory Committee and serves on the NASDAQ Listing Qualifications Hearing Panel and the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board's Standing Advisory Group. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Kofi Annan's so-called peace plan for Syria.
You can't hide your lying eyes. And your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes. And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we'll be talking about Syria in the next segment in 20 minutes' time. But joining us now is Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. He's a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy, where he moved after a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesperson at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Ian, thank you very much. Good to be back.
Good to talk to you again, Wendell. And unfortunately, all of that effort that the president and the Democrats put into passing the Affordable Care Act, by a whisker, could be just completely blown away by the Supreme Court. Yesterday's questioning and arguments on the part of the Obama administration were less than sterling. And then today, the attorney arguing for the 26 states against so-called Obamacare is arguing before the Supreme Court, saying if the individual mandate is unconstitutional, and the rest of the act cannot stand. So that was pretty much the subject of discussion in today's Supreme Court, that taking it away would completely gut it. What's your sense of where this conversation is heading, even though we know that just because of performances of attorneys before the Supreme Court and questions from the justices themselves don't necessarily tell you exactly how they're going to rule.
And that's right. And I continue to think that they probably will uphold the constitutionality of the law. Keep in mind that the challenges have gone through lower courts, and more courts have upheld the constitutionality of the law than have declared unconstitutional, including the individual mandate. And that includes from judges who have been conservative judges. So these same questions and these same observations have been made by other judges that have ultimately declared the law constitutional. But we never know. My guess is as good as anybody's, but I tend to think that the justices, when they sit right down to determine what to do, they will have to realize that the health care for more than 300 million people is essentially in their hands, and certainly for the 50 million people who don't have coverage, and for many others who are underinsured. In fact, I think they probably will realize that if they declare it unconstitutional, it's going to create great chaos in the health insurance market. I also think they realize that health insurance companies, frankly, need the individual mandate for their business models to be sustainable. If it's declared unconstitutional, I think it's very reasonable to assume that the end of the health insurance market as we know it will see that sooner rather than later.
Well, we've had some surprises from the Supreme Court fairly recently with Citizens United, so they can do radical and unexpected things. And even though, there's nothing from today's Supreme Court arguments to leave one with much hope here. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg basically is in trying to defend this attack on the Affordable Care Act says that if the central requirement, the so-called individual mandate, was deemed unconstitutional, the court would have to decide between a wrecking operation and a salvage job. Now, some, believe it or not, Wendell, some Democratic strategists are saying that this might be a good thing, that if this were to happen, this could give the president something to run on in November, you know, saying that, you know, that those people that are now young people who are on their parents' health care, that's going to be taken away, and those with pre-existing conditions will have their health care taken away, and they'll be able to paint the Republicans as the bad guys. But the reality is this, I think, would have the opposite effect, surely. It would make the president look impotent and unable to deliver.
It's hard to say, and it would certainly be something that would have to be handled very skillfully. But keep in mind, if it's declared unconstitutional, we'll have headline after headline about what the unraveling actually is, what the consequences of that unraveling would be. Point up, I think, the importance. It would take people back to a reminder of why we had to have health care reform in the first place. So it can go either way. What has struck me is that the Solicitor General, who's been arguing the government's case before the Supreme Court, has not been all that persuasive and doesn't seem to have been all that articulate in making the strong case and a persuasive case to the court. And that seems to be a continuation, frankly, of the administration's ineptness in many ways of communicating about the Affordable Care Act. It's little wonder that 2 years after the passage of the legislation, a majority of Americans, when polled, still say they are opposed to the law.
Well, that's always been the mystery of how this administration, from the very outset, were never explained what they were doing and why they were doing what they were doing, and why they put Max Baucus in charge of it, and why it took all this time, and why single payer was never even on the table, and why they didn't take the simpler approach, which is expanding on the existing government program that wouldn't be facing these challenges, Medicare. And then another question is, why did they backload all of the benefits so that it's not until, 2019 or something before people really, the average Americans will be able to recognize that this is a good thing for them, that they're actually, short of a more ideal coverage like single pay would provide, they, at least they'll be getting a better deal. The only people who are getting a better deal now are the parents, the kids under 26, being able to have their parents' coverage and people with pre-existing conditions. But you don't hear a lot about that. All you hear is this constant drumbeat of negativity.
You do, and it's clear it's that the president was very ill-advised, and maybe some of these decisions were his. I suspect that more than likely they were recommendations from advisors who felt they knew what they were doing, but certainly did not, in terms of developing the strategy for the actual legislation itself. Both in the White House and in the Congress, you're right. Max Baucus kept holding out and delaying work on the bill to the point that apparently assuming or thinking that there could be some bipartisan support when that was never really going to be in the cards. It was just one strategic blunder after another. What we wound up with was a bill that was with the individual mandate at its core, which the president, when he was campaigning for president, said he was against, and he was for the public option. But based on advice from his strategist and from or his advisors, and clearly intense lobbying and very effective lobbying from the health insurance industry, we got what we wound up with. And we have seen since during the debate and since then that there has just been a lack of a strategy to communicate the benefits of the law. So, yes, put a lot of blame on the administration and members of Congress for not planning this very well at all.
So if the president, coming into this, wanted to have the public option, which is a kind of a step in the direction of a single payer, and wasn't able to do it. And that was probably because somebody told him early in his administration that you don't have a lot of power. The real people that run America are the big, powerful corporations. And that, you know, that the only, that you've got to you know, join up with them. Otherwise, you get nowhere. So he then decides to go along with what they want, which is the very thing that's under threat now, the individual mandate, because it's a guarantee for insurance companies if everybody's covered. That's good for them. They obviously won the round, but then they seem to turn on him at the same time. So walk us through the mentality, since you work for the two of the biggest insurance companies for many, many years, and know apart from greed, what other motives are involved here?
Well, it is satisfying Wall Street's expectations and satisfying the shareholders' expectations. That's what is really at the heart here. It's not determining what is in the best interest of the people who are enrolled in their health plans or the population as a whole. What happened is that the president was convinced that that Washington is indeed controlled by special interests. It's why deals were cut with the drug companies and the hospitals and the doctors, as the, you know, even before the first draft of the legislation was written, and there had to be negotiations apparently with the insurance companies because much of the bill involves insurance reform. The insurance companies going into reform, they felt that some kind of reform was inevitable, so they wanted to shape the discussions and shape public opinion, and they were very determined that the individual mandate be a central part of it, and they were also equally determined that the public option not be in the final bill. They were very skillful. They knew exactly who to send to the White House to represent the industry. They knew exactly who to work on Capitol Hill, and they got what they wanted. What they, you know, they had to live with some things they don't want. They don't. They would rather not have had the ban on pre-existing conditions. They'd rather not have had the other consumer protections and things that really benefit consumers. Their game plan is to try to make sure that this bill goes, the law goes forward with the individual mandate, and then to try to elect as many friendly members of Congress or reelect them and to replace Democrats as best they can so that the next Congress and the next president will begin stripping out the consumer protections. That is what they really want, and that could be, you know, absolutely the worst nightmare for consumers.
Again, I speak with Wendell Potter, who is a senior fellow in healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. He moved there after a long career in the for-profit health industry as a chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc. So the insurance companies basically had to make Obama turn 180 degrees away from what he wanted to do and accept the reality of what they wanted to do. And their centerpiece is the very thing under attack now, which is the individual mandate. That is what they wanted. It's a giveaway to them. It means that everybody in the country has got to carry insurance, which means millions and millions of customers for them. So is it possible that they're that cynical, that they don't mind the Supreme Court shredding this and basically killing this bill? I mean,
they need this legislation. They need this law because they realize, the executives do, the top executives do, that the business models of the insurance companies are not sustainable. They have shown they've shown that they are not able to control medical costs. The way they've been able to reap their profits in recent years is by just constantly jacking up rates, making the people and employers pay more, and also by shifting more and more of the cost of health care from them to us by moving us into higher and higher deductible plans. That's not ultimately sustainable. We've been seeing over the past several years that more and more small businesses are not able to offer coverage, which is one of the reasons why we have now 50 million people without coverage. They've been refusing to sell coverage to more and more people. And when you do that, and when you also keep shifting more and more the cost of care, unless there is a mandate, people are just increasingly going to say, I can't afford this. It's not of value to me. And that's what's going to happen.
Well, obviously, again, in trying to understand, Wendell Potter, why the people who designed this bill have not been able to, one, explain it to the public, two, explain its virtues to the public, as slim as they are, and three, defend it. And I'm just astounded that they've created this mechanism in order to get the individual mandate, to get everybody to join an insurance pool with the so-called penalties, which is at the heart of what the Supreme Court's talking about. Obviously, the conservatives on the Supreme Court are talking, they say it's all about the Constitution, but it's like everything that seems to go through that court, they dress it up in all kinds of lofty legalese. But at the end of the day, the conservatives vote for power and privilege, the connected over the alienated, the rich over the poor, the corporation over the union, etc. I mean, there's just no mystery about their pattern of voting. And so it serves them to talk in these very lofty constitutional terms. But at the end of the day, there are very few people talking about the heart and soul of what's involved here, and that is the quality of life in America and the health of millions and millions of Americans. And, you know, why they didn't, for example, fund it through a tax credit, which would have avoided the very arguments, because I find most of what the conservatives are arguing is just phony. They're just acting at the behest of the powerful. They simply don't want to take care of anybody but themselves.
I think I don't disagree with you, but they're pragmatic people. I think part of what you've been hearing from the justices is just for the base, if you will, for the say things that will make the conservatives happy, to please those who are saying this is a bad law. And at the end of the day, I think that they will uphold it, and here's why. They have to be smart enough to realize that by declaring it unconstitutional, it's going to undermine the so-called free market of health insurance, and it is just not sustainable. And the best way for them to hasten the day for us to get single payer, in my view, is to declare it unconstitutional. They have to be smarter to know that the current business model of health insurance is not sustainable, and it will just unravel. It will collapse, and we will have millions and millions more people who are uninsured, and millions of people who are on the hook to pay a lot more for health care when they get sick.
Well, Wendell Potter, just in closing then, do you think that maybe this could be a blessing in disguise? I mean, single payer wasn't, maybe in what Obama wished, or at least he indicated he might wish it. It was never on the table, never seriously discussed. If it could come back in this kind of Pavlovian way when the whole thing just collapses and out of the ashes is born something that's actually going to work, you're saying that could be the unintended consequences, but the people that are pushing the Affordable Care Act, which is going to benefit the insurance companies, the insurance companies are too smart to allow this to happen. Is that a summary?
That's right. But this may be beyond the power of the insurance companies to influence the court. You don't know what it's going to do, but that's why I do think it probably will be upheld. If it's declared unconstitutional, I think you're exactly right. We will then have to have a serious discussion about the best way to bring people into coverage and to control costs, and single payer will have to be part of that discussion finally.
But do you think the president at that point, Wendell, could go to the American public and say, look, the powerful interest in this country, the 1%, have struck again, and I'm sorry I did my best, but I wish I would have done what I originally intended, and now I'm going to do what I originally intended.
That's exactly what he better do. He ought to do. He ought to be the guy who many of us thought would be president.
I see. So you think, just in terms of the politics of it, that you could turn this defeat and humiliation into a victory if you're the president of the United States?
I think so. I think it absolutely could be done, and I think it would be an opportunity to point to the power of the special interests, because that, Ian, is really why we are in this predicament. It is because, as you noted, politicians and the members of the Congress and the president don't control Washington. It is controlled by special interests who have become increasingly powerful. And this could be a way of showing just how corrupting our system has become, or corrupting this unlimited power and influence and the corruption of unlimited money, just what it is costing us as a country.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. He's a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy, where he moved after a long career in the for-profit health industry as a chief corporate spokesperson at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Syria.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. It could be some cosmopolitan style.
Now there's a woman on my block, just sits there, facing the hills, saying, who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away?
Who's gonna take away? Whose license to kill? Now he's hell-bent for destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Muraf Juhayati, who is a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He is currently professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East and South Asian Center for Strategic Studies. He also served as the National Program Officer in Syria for the United Nations Development Program and as an advisor to the Syrian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Muraf Juhayati.
Thank you very much.
And there are two conflicting, I don't know how conflicting they are, but there are two things that the United Nations are seen to be pushing here. On the one hand, the former head of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, has a peace plan that's largely endorsed by Russia and China. He is now... And Ban Ki-moon is on his way to Baghdad for the Arab League summit, where he's going to join in trying to sell that. And I believe the Arab foreign ministers in Baghdad have said that they are going to go aboard that plan. But while this is happening, then you have UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay accusing the Syrian government of systematically detaining, torturing, and killing children. I'm just astounded that cynicism seems to be overwhelming morality here.
It is astounding. One hand does not know what the other hand of the UN is doing. Kofi Annan's plan, I think, was worded with a lot of care in order to get Russia and China on board. It is, of course, you remember those two states that had vetoed at least twice in the Security Council condemnations of Assad and any talk of Assad stepping aside. So he wanted very much Russia and China to be on board. The problem with that is that in the Kofi Annan plan, it calls for a political dialogue between the Assad regime and the opposition, therefore discounting really any accountability to the Assad regime. No accountability for the murder of 9,000 Syrians, no talk of Assad stepping down. So although Kofi Annan had very much Russia and China in mind, he didn't have the demands of the Syrian people in mind, and this is what matters most. the Assad regime should be made accountable, and there should at least be wording of him stepping aside in view of forming a transitional government in Syria.
But Kofi Annan's plan is an absolutely non-starter, given that as a precondition, the opposition is being asked to surrender to a regime that's killing its own people and trusts that the Assad clan will have any interest in reform. It seems like a very cynical ploy pushed by the Russians and the Chinese and Assad to basically say, see, we tried to have a peace plan and the opposition rejected it.
That's right. And Assad is only stalling for time. He has had now a year to implement serious reforms. He has not. He has accepted the plan only orally, and as you know, the ink did not dry on the acceptance of the Annan plan, that the Assad regime is continuing its violence against Syrian civilians. Today, the cities of Homs was bombarded once again, along with the city of Sarakhib and the city of Idlib and the countryside of Hama. There were countless killings today. And Assad has accepted initiatives in the past, and we know that he has been lying. And this is, I think, one more lie. He is simply stalling for time in the hope that this rebellion against him will be crushed.
So, Muhaf Jujati, just on this, trying to figure out more about this kind of the two faces of the UN, if you will, Kofi Annan and Navi Pillay, the UN Commissioner for Human Rights. Navi Pillay is describing what's happening to the children in Syria. What they've done to the children for whatever purpose in large numbers, hundreds detained and tortured. It's just horrendous. Children shot in the knees, held together with adults in really inhumane conditions, denied medical treatment for their injuries, either held as hostages or as sources of information. And then he goes on to say that the United Nations Security Council has enough reliable information to refer the Assad regime to the International Criminal Court for its human rights abuses. So is there a possible two-track here, that you've got the cynical Assad Russian-Chinese track that's designed to go nowhere, or even though the Arab foreign ministers appear to be taking it up, I don't know how they're going to do that because Syria's not even present because they've been kicked out of the Arab League. But just walk us through the possibilities of a two-track here.
Well, again, the track of Kofi Annan is a non-starter, as you rightly said. It is not going to be accepted by the opposition, especially that the murders continue. It might be accepted by Russia and China, but then again, these are not the victims of the Assad regime's brutality. Assad rightly belongs in the International Criminal Court. What is going on, simply, and here I don't want to employ harsh rhetoric or propaganda, but it is mass murder, including children. So again, I do not see how Kofi Annan seriously thinks that the Assad regime is going to sit at the table with the opposition movement, that they are going to resolve this, and in the end, hug and kiss. It is truly very cynical. It is simply a non-starter.
But Muhaf Jujati, it's not just Kofi Annan. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called on Syrian President Bashar Assad today to implement a peace plan proposed by the UN Arab League envoy Ban Ki-moon. I strongly urge President Assad of Syria to put those commitments into immediate effect. There is no time to waste. This is what he said at a press briefing in Kuwait just before he went to Baghdad for the Arab League summit, which began today.
Unfortunately, there has been, I think, a stepping back, not only by Ban Ki-moon, but by the international community. The position of the United States has been and continues to be that Assad must step aside. And this position is shared by most in the international community. They, however, I think, want to give one voice, a united voice, a united message to Assad. Well, in that united voice, they have watered down very much those earlier calls for him to step down. In fact, the Annan plan does not mention it at all. And again, Assad is monopolizing on this in order to gain time, in order to crush the rebellion. That simply is not going to work. And the international community, the United States, and like-minded states are going to have to step up to the plate, whether Russia and China like it or not.
Again, I'm speaking with Murat Juhayati, who is a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asian Center for Strategic Studies. And last November, President Assad agreed to a deal proposed by the Arab League, which actually is in many ways similar to the Annan plan, the withdrawal of government forces from residential areas, freeing political prisoners, and good faith negotiations with the opposition. And none of these promises were kept.
That's right. The Kofi Annan plan is based on this very Arab plan that you are mentioning, Ian, and the Arab plan, again, went nowhere. Assad did not withdraw heavy military equipment from cities. He did not allow unfettered access to the international media. He did not free any political prisoners. And therefore, that Arab initiative died, and the monitors were withdrawn and not to be brought back in. Kofi Annan based himself on that plan that failed. And so this tells me his plan is going to also fail. Why he is willing to give Assad more time is truly beyond me and is really totally disingenuous, if not outrageous.
But assuming that because the Arab League foreign ministers and Ban Ki-moon have all said that they've endorsed this plan and their meeting, so presumably they're going to discuss it, the odd part about it is that Syria is not present, and Syria said that they won't deal with the Arab League because they've been suspended. They'll only deal with the individual states. So again, it seems to have provided them with some wiggle room. I mean, just to briefly go through the six-point plan. One, this is Annan's six-point plan. One, Syrian-led political process to address the aspirations and concerns of the Syrian people. Two, UN-supervised cessation of armed violence in all its forms by all parties to protect civilians. Three, all parties to ensure provision of humanitarian assistance to all areas affected by the fighting and implement a daily two-hour humanitarian pause. Four, authorities to intensify the pace and scale of release of arbitrarily detained persons. Five, authorities to ensure freedom of movement throughout the country of journalists. Six, authorities to respect freedom of association and the right to demonstrate peacefully. He hasn't done that. He's never agreed to that in the past. Is there any way that he can agree with it or would be forced to agree with it if it has the imprimatur of the UN, which it seems to have, and the Arab League?
He will do what he has done already, which is to agree to it orally and to violate each and every one of the clauses that you read. He will not allow peaceful demonstrations without shooting at them. He has not withdrawn equipment from cities. He will not allow the access to journalists and so on and so forth. Because if he does in the end, it will be a carnival-like atmosphere in Syria wherein all Syrian cities and all Syrians would be demonstrating peacefully. That would be the end of his regime. If the international media were to go in and to document the mass murder that has been taking place by his security forces, he will be done in. So again, on the one hand, he is going to agree, as he has in the past. On the other hand, he is not going to do anything. And in the meantime, this is only going to gain him time in order to kill more civilians that are protesting against him.
So what's happening with the opposition then, Murat Juhayati? They've been meeting in Istanbul this week, and they apparently have agreed to work under the one umbrella. Is that any? Do you have any more information of what they've agreed to?
I know of at least 40 small groups and movements that have all agreed that the Syrian National Council is the sole and legitimate representative of the Syrian people. The Syrian National Council is the interlocutor. It is the future leaders of Syria. It's not all good news. There are some elements that have walked out, namely the Kurdish elements. And my guess is it's because the Kurdish movement know that they have, let's call it, a swing vote now. now, they can make or break this revolution, really. And so they are trying to maximize their demands. They are seizing the moment in order to get all the demands that they want from the Syrian National Council. But overall, I believe the Syrian opposition today is more united than it has ever been before. This is not to say that it is totally united, but again, it has united more than ever before. And when the Friends of Syria will meet, and this is a group of at least 70 states in early April in Istanbul, I think they would be facing a Syrian National Council that is truly the interlocutor of the Syrian people.
Well, just in closing, Maruf Shujadi, this whole thing's starting to feel like Bosnia in the 1990s and Kosovo, exactly the same MO, particularly in the part of the West and NATO and the United States. Oh, we can't do anything. Terrible things are happening. It's true. Genocide is going on, but it's too complicated, and we don't know who the arms would go to if we sent arms in. All of exactly the same arguments. And frankly, I don't know whatever happened. The Saudis and the Qataris were supposed to be helping out the Syrian opposition. There's no evidence. I mean, all the reports I get is that the fighters are being routed because they don't have any weapons, and they're just brave people, you know, standing up against a modern professional army with pea shooters.
Ian, I am in total agreement with you. This is a Kosovo repeat. At the time, the international community was very hesitant. In Kosovo, there was increasing radicalization as a result of the murders that were taking place there. In addition, there was the influx of Islamist fighters that went to Kosovo, which got the attention of the international community. And then they intervened. And when they did intervene, the murders stopped. So I think we are in a phase now where the international community, particularly Western states, are beginning to be jolted into action because murder is taking place before them. A regime that is not at all hesitant or reluctant to use weapons against civilians. With regards to the Saudis and the Qataris, I believe that they are going to finish with this Arab summit and see what comes out of the Friends of Syria. But I think that they are more determined than other Arab states to facilitate at least the arming of the Free Syria Army so that it can, so that there can be somewhat of a balance of power with the forces of Assad.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. Maruf Shujadi, again, Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics, and currently Professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.